Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin Rose Show. I'm really excited to have Dr. Andrew Weil on the show today. We cover a lot of topics, some really fun ones too, like medicinal mushrooms, his love for matcha tea. We talk about brain-enhancing compounds, the effects of omega-3s, microdosing, fasting, controlling glucose, like a whole slew of really fun stuff. I can't even tell you how much I respect the work that Dr. Weil has done over the years. I've been following him since the mid-90s when my mom back in the day used to get his newsletter delivered to our house. This was like a mailed, like 15-page little pamphlet that you would get every month, I think every month or every quarter, something like that. But he would talk about all these different herbs and supplements and compounds that he was trying and things to avoid. He was one of the first people that stood up and started to fight against trans fats and was talking about all the dangers of trans fats. And eventually that resulted in them being listed on, required to be listed on food labels, which was a big deal. And it's certainly saved a ton of people's lives. So he's done some great work and he's been, rewarded for that. I mean, he has a really popular website, drweil.com. He's also been featured on the cover of Time magazine twice. Time named him one of the 25 most influential Americans and one of the 100 most influential people in the world. He's been on Oprah, The Today Show, Larry King Live, just so many times when that show was airing. He used to be on there, I feel like, like once a month or something like that. It was crazy. He was a ton of appearances there. I love that he is a traditionally trained doctor at Harvard Medical School. And so, you know, there's times when his approach is very Western, but then the majority of his time, he really has an Eastern approach using, you know, food first, food is our medicine and herbs as our medicine. So I just love that about him. He's a true pioneer in this space. So I'm excited to chat with him today. One thing I will say, we talk about matcha tea, and Dr. Weil was one of the first people to get me into tea way back in the day. We became friends here probably about 7 years ago. And then he came to me and said, hey, I'm going to start importing matcha tea, some of the highest grades of it in from Japan. And I was, of course, really excited. He sent me probably, I don't know, 15, 20 different teas to taste with him. And we kind of talked about which flavors we liked and enjoyed the most. And then that ended up turning into a business, which I actually helped fund. I don't have anything to do with the day-to-day operations of the business, but I did invest in it. So anytime I do one of these podcasts, we talk about a lot of products and things like that. And I would say probably every, I don't know, 5 or so episodes or 10 episodes in, I'll have a product or something that I've invested in. And I always want to call that out because I think it's really important to have some integrity there and make sure to mention when there is an investment that's happened. So anyway, I love the tea. That's why I invested. So I hope you enjoy that as well. We're going to put a coupon code in the show notes for you to get 15% off your purchase there as well. All right, everybody, let's talk about sponsors. This sponsor of this show is Audible. It's a service that I've been using for over 10 years. I can, you guys know that I don't have a lot of sponsors on the show. If you look at, go back through my podcast, I have a sponsor on the show probably one every 3 or 4 episodes. And there's a reason for that. And that's primarily because I get offers to have content on the show all the time, sponsors, but I can't really get behind and back up and really truly believe in the things that I have on the show. I'd rather not have the money. And so that, you know, when I'm recommending something, it comes from the heart and it's actually something that I personally use. So Audible has been something I've been using for probably close to 10 years now. It's awesome. You get a credit every single month, and regardless of price, you can just pick up an audiobook with that credit. If you don't use the credit, it rolls over to the next month. So it's super simple. The thing that I really like, and I've done this a couple times, if you don't like the audiobook, you just reach out to them and you exchange it. They don't ask you any questions. And also the best part is that you own these books. So you can go back and re-listen at any time. And it's, even if you cancel your membership, you still have the books. It's pretty awesome. The book that I've been listening to recently is called Mindful Drinking, which was really timely given that we're, you know, January New Year's resolutions, things like that. So it taught me some ways to kind of slowly appreciate alcohol and some little kind of a blueprint for how to drink less alcohol. So for me, it's never been like I'm the person that just gets completely hammered. It's just been that I have social functions and dinners and things to go out to with friends. And all of a sudden I'm like, wow, it's been, you know, back to back to back nights of alcohol. And that starts to like, you know, your sleep starts to suffer and your mood starts to suffer and all that good stuff. So anyway, Mindful Drinking, cool book. This woman, she breaks down a blueprint for you to how to consume less. For me, what that means is it's the 3x3 plan. So a maximum of 3 drinks in any given night, always spaced out by a day. So you cannot do 2 consecutive nights of drinking, and then a maximum of 3 nights of drinking per week. So 4 completely sober nights. So that ends up being 9 drinks a week. They sound like a lot. I think it is, but you know, there's some nights where I have 1 drink and then the next night I'm like, well, I can't drink tonight because that would be back-to-back nights. So anyway, it's just a fun way. There's a lot of really cool tools in there for how to deal with social situations. For me, the hardest thing, it's not when I'm at home. It's when I go out to like big social functions and I don't know anybody and I'm like, I feel awkward. I'm kind of an introvert like that, even though I can do podcasts and stuff like that. It's weird. My brain is broken. But anyway, I kind of like having a glass or two of wine to kind of like, you know, that social lubricant, and just makes me a little bit more fun and interactive with people. So she tells you some really cool little tricks and kind of how to avoid that and how to even act like you have a drink, even though you don't. I've been doing a lot of bitters and soda, so you can like hold what looks like a beverage, but it's actually not. Anyway, the book is Mindful Drinking. You can pick it up with one of your Audible credits when you sign up. Use my link though, audible.com/KevinRose. That will let Audible know that you heard about it through our podcast, or text Kevin Rose, no spaces, to 500-500. That'll get you a free book and a free 30-day trial. Really love this service. The other thing I would say book-wise that I recommend, How to Change Your Mind from Michael Pollan. That one has been recommended by Tim Ferriss. I've had Michael Pollan on the show, Peter Attia. I know Joe Rogan's talked about it in the past. So really, really kind of crazy in-depth research around the use of psychedelics for therapeutic purposes. Even if you don't ever think you'd try anything like that, it's kind of crazy to see where the world is going and how science is progressing. And we're able to deal with things like end of life and cancer patients. And I thought it was a great book. Michael Pollan is also an amazing author. You should check out his other stuff as well. Lots of knowledge to unlock with Audible. Make sure to sign up with my link, audible.com/KevinRose, or text Kevin Rose, no spaces, to 500-500. You will get your free book and free 30-day trial. Pick up Mindful Drinking. All right. So with that, let's jump into it. This is Dr. Andrew Weil. So Dr. Weil, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure, Kevin.
It's been a long time, man. We haven't hung out in a couple of years. I'm bummed.
So let's correct that.
Seriously, I think the last time we were hanging, you made some awesome spot prawns.
I did. You visited me on Cortez Island in British Columbia, and we cooked some local spot prawns and tried a lot of other things too.
Those are magical prawns. I have never had prawns that good. Those are phenomenal. Whenever Daria and I see them like out, like, you know, once a year, whenever they come in season, we always pick them up because it reminds us of our time out there.
Oh, great. So, well, please come back.
Yeah, I'd love to. Well, I'm glad to have you on the show. I want to jump into a whole variety of different topics. Mm-hmm. You know, in my mind, one of the things that you were so kind of on the cutting edge and of, or have been for, gosh, a very long time, has been discovering new compounds and new, and actually potential kind of pitfalls that we might run into in terms of nutrition. You were one of the first people I remember to say, stay away from partially hydrogenated oils.
That's right.
Gosh, that was, how long ago did you first start kind of calling that out as being a potential problem for health?
Mid-1980s.
So that was like a decade before they banned them. Is that right?
Absolutely.
That's crazy. Well, I want to thank you for that, because sure. I started looking on labels at that point and I was trying to identify what was it about these oils that caught your attention?
You know, when you change the chemistry of fatty acids, you often increase their toxicity and especially their carcinogenicity. So artificially hydrogenated fats really drive atherosclerosis, increased risk of heart disease and cancer.
Yeah. Was that apparent to you in the science at the time, or had you just kind of like, what brought it to your attention?
I had been interested in the chemistry of fats and the different the ways that different fats affected health. And that was one of the issues that I came across. The other one that I was very concerned about, people were promoting polyunsaturated oils as being good for heart health. That's, you know, sesame, soy, corn, canola. And those unsaturated oils are very chemically unstable if they're exposed to heat, oxygen, light. They break down in ways that also form pro-inflammatory carcinogenic compounds. And these are the oils that we were being told to eat as opposed to saturated fats.
Right. And so today, what's your cabinet look like in your, is it typically just olive oil or what do you?
Primarily consider? Olive oil and a few other fats that are mainly monounsaturated fat. A very good one that I've been using for cooking is algae oil. Are you familiar with that, Kevin?
No, I'm not.
There's a brand called Thrive that you can get on Amazon. And this is has a low environmental footprint. Algae are cultivated and oil is extracted from them. It's almost entirely monounsaturated fat. So very stable and neutral taste, very high smoke point, higher than any other oil. So that's one, if I don't want the flavor of olive oil, that's one that I use.
Hmm.
And then I use some flavored oils like toasted sesame oil, walnut oil, hazelnut oil. I use them moderately for not heating them.
And when you do heat an oil, is it the smoke point? Like when you see them, because everyone's been there where you have, the stove turned up too hot and all of a sudden it starts to put off this like smoke because it hits a certain temperature. Is that when the oils are changing chemically?
Yeah, but that's also a toxic cloud and you don't want to breathe that or be exposed to it. And you know what? I'm horrified when I see cooking shows on television where people have saute pans or woks and they heat oil till it's smoking and then put food in. Very unhealthy.
Yeah.
By the way, Kevin, a lot of people are concerned about heating olive oil. I get asked that question a lot. And the latest research shows it's just fine to heat olive oil.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I know a few years ago that was a big issue. You had actually kind of suggested against heating olive oil too hot, right?
Right. Well, again, you don't want to get near the smoke point, but it's okay to saute with olive oil.
That's great. It's good to know. One of the things I've been fascinated with living out here in Oregon now is we get this, I go to the local grocery store and I have not seen as many varietals of mushrooms out here. It is awesome living in the Pacific Northwest.
You're in mushroom heaven.
I love it.
So, I got interested in mushrooms first in Oregon. I was living in Eugene in the early 1970s, and I began meeting mushroomers and learning how to pick wild mushrooms, and I became just fascinated with that whole field.
Yeah, it's really awesome. I remember picking up a book that you were on the cover of. I don't think you didn't write it, but I think it was Paul Stamen's book, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I take it you're pretty well versed in all things medicinal mushrooms. I'd love to pick your brain on kind of which ones
sure.
You tend to gravitate towards and enjoy. I go out to the store and I just like try a new mushroom. So I've been buying lion's mane now that mm-hmm. it's in season right now, cutting it up, sauteing it a little bit with some olive oil and just enjoying it in its natural state. Which mushrooms do you kind of gravitate towards in terms of their medicinal properties?
Well, first of all, do you know that I'm the one who turned Paul Stamets onto medicinal mushrooms?
I did not know that. That's awesome.
And this was also in the early 1980s. And I had been studying traditional Chinese medicine and was fascinated by how prominent mushrooms were and their pharmacopoeia. And also the fact that in this part of the world, we never have looked to mushrooms as sources of new medications. So that struck me as very odd. And I began paying attention to the literature in China and Japan on medicinal mushrooms, got Paul interested in that subject, have been calling for research in that area forever. And now finally, there's beginning to be a great deal of research on medicinal effects of mushrooms. One big group of mushrooms that are very beneficial are the polypores. These are the shelf fungi that grow on living and dead trees and forests. They are all non-toxic. There are no poisonous polypores. Some of them are inedible because they're woody or bitter. Some are edible. And this includes things like reishi and turkey tail. A lot of these have immune enhancing properties and increase resistance to infection and to cancer. So there are many products of those out on the market, liquid extracts, solid extracts. You mentioned lion's mane. Mm-hmm. That's a particularly interesting one. It's a culinary mushroom that's quite good, but it has a unique nerve growth factor in it that seems to be beneficial for the nervous system in general. And I've seen good results in people with peripheral neuropathy, people with various kinds of brain problems. And a lot of people are reporting benefits in enhancing memory. People think it may protect us against dementia. So it's a very interesting one.
Yeah, that's very cool. Are there ones that you take on a kind of daily or weekly basis?
Yes, I take some of Paul's products. I take a liquid extract called Stamet 7, and mm-hmm. I take an encapsulated extract called Mike Immunity. And both of these are combinations of about seven different species of Asian mushrooms. And there's some evidence that consuming multiple species gives you more health benefits than any single species.
One of the things that I've been fascinated with is I just heard how many varietals of mushrooms are out there and have yet to be classified. And
true.
How can we get involved? Like I know I sent you like a text or an email about this like a few weeks ago, but I'm curious, like, you know, how do you know when you're out there foraging? And I know you can do the spore count where you can like lay a mushroom down, let it kind of off gas its spores, and then look at the print and identify it to know if it's edible or dangerous or not. But how does one, let's just say you discover a new type of mushroom, how do you figure out if it's toxic?
You know, you learn mushrooms by the way you learn people, by spending time with them, learning to recognize their face. And I think the best way to learn mushrooms is from people who know them. That's how I did it. It's much harder to learn them from books or from any kind of printed or pictorial information. So my best advice would be to seek out people who know mushrooms and spend time with them and go out foraging with them.
What if you want to classify a new mushroom, or you find something that, you know, like you had mentioned that a lot of these polypores are inedible because of their flavor profiles. Like, what if you want to get in there and figure out, well, they may be not taste good, but okay, they might be beneficial in terms of health?
The first rule is you want to be able to identify mushrooms that can kill you. And there right. aren't very many of those. Most of them are in one group called Amanitas. And those are very easy mushrooms to recognize. They're big mushrooms. They have white gills and white spore print. They often have a veil around the stem and a cup at the base. So once you know Amanitas and stay away from them, the worst that's going to happen to you eating an unknown mushroom is you're going to get a stomach ache of one degree or another. Mm-hmm. There are also a few deadly species that are little brown mushrooms that nobody would bother picking, except possibly magic mushroom collectors in your part of the world who might confuse them with one of the psychoactive species.
I see.
Once you know mushrooms that can kill you, you have a lot of latitude. You mentioned spore print. You put a mushroom on a piece of white paper, put a mushroom cap, put a glass over it, wait 24 hours, and then you look to see what spores it's dropped. And there are major color for classifications, whether they're white, black, purple, black, brown, green, and that guides you to certain groups of mushrooms, but it's not a definitive identification.
It's a lot of fun. It's scary to me, but you know, going out there just being like not knowing if I'm picking the right thing. But I guess some of the more well-known ones are on the easier. And you're right. I know there's some societies out here locally that you can join up with and actually go out foraging with professionals. And it sounds like the best.
Yeah, I would recommend that. For many years, I helped organize a mushroom festival in Telluride, Colorado, which was great fun. It was every August. And if the rains are right in the San Juan Mountains, there's a great variety of mushrooms. And the good thing about our event is that it was run by amateurs, not professionals. The professionals, mycologists, often make people very afraid of mushrooms. We had very good experts. Gary Linkoff, who wrote the Audubon Guide on Mushroom, is very, very knowledgeable, but he's not a PhD mycologist. So we had a lot of fun at those festivals. And one of the events that I organized was an edibility unknown party, where on one day we would cook up mushrooms of which there were no reports of whether they were edible or not.
Oh my God.
And, you know, people ate them at their own risk. But in the years that we did that, I saw no adverse reactions. We found one mushroom that was quite delicious that nobody had tried, and a few that were just horrible. One tasted like a tire. But, you know, I think the people exaggerate the risks of mushroom poisoning.
That's so funny. I feel like you couldn't get away with that today. Like,
probably not.
In terms of mushrooms that you found that, you know, if someone's listening to this and they haven't tried any of these medicinal mushrooms, is there anyone that jumps out where you can say, okay, if you take this in supplemental form, or you go and buy it and you actually cook it and consume it, you'll get some true noticeable effect? Because I know a lot of these things are, you know, enhancing immunity, which you're not going to obviously notice. Is there any for energy, like people say cordyceps, or
I would say for energy cordyceps, and I think people can notice that fairly quickly, reishi mushroom has a very significant anti-inflammatory effect. So anyone that has an inflammatory condition, I think it's worth trying that, and you can get results similar to those with ibuprofen.
Wow. That's awesome. I want to talk about tea.
Yes.
I know that you and I have been obviously fans of tea for a very long time, and gosh, it was here probably... Trying to think about when we started sampling those matcha teas. Was that maybe 3 years ago, somewhere around
there? I think it was 3 years ago.
Yeah. So around 3 years ago, to give people the backstory, I obviously knew that you were a big fan of matcha tea for when did you first discover matcha? Because I think this is a great story.
I went to Japan when I was 17. This was in the fall of 1959, long ago. And Japan was... still recovering from the Second World War. Things were cheap. It was a very different place. I was an exchange student, and I lived with a family on the outskirts of Tokyo. We were supposed to have an English-speaking son in that family, but his English was minimal, so there was very little communication. On the second night that I was there, the mother of the family took me to her next door neighbor, who was a practitioner of chanoyu, tea ceremony, and they did a tea ceremony. So it was the mother of my host mother and the neighbor and me seated around the low table on tatami, and she did the tea ceremony. Two things caught my attention. One was the color of the matcha, that brilliant green, just captivated me. And also the chasen, the bamboo whisk that's used to whisk matcha and water into a froth. This is carved from one piece of bamboo. It's one of the most wonderful things that I've seen. Then there was the flavor and aroma of matcha. The whole thing was terrific. So right from that moment, I was a fan of that. And it was unavailable in the U.S. I brought cans of it back. And then over the next 10, 15 years, I made several trips to Japan. And whenever I went, I would take matcha and I'd also bring it back to the States. I knew no one here who heard of it or knew anything about it. So my interest in it goes a long way back.
Yeah. And for people that don't know, one of the cool benefits and things about matcha tea is you're actually consuming the entire leaf, which is great.
Correct. And also the leaves for matcha are grown in a very special way. They're heavily shaded for a few weeks before harvest. And in response to that, the leaves become bigger, thinner, produce more chlorophyll, more L-theanine, and more of the flavoring agents in tea. So it's a very labor-intensive process to produce this. Also, matcha is so finely ground, it has a big surface area and oxidizes very readily. So if it's exposed to air and not stored properly, it loses that vibrant green color. It becomes yellowish or grayish, it becomes bitter, loses its flavor. And unfortunately, many people here have never tried quality matcha. They've only had really inferior stuff.
Yeah, I'm curious why you think that's the case. I mean, I know that matcha over the last, 5 years or so, maybe 3 years, has just absolutely exploded.
Mm-hmm. True.
You know, you go to New York cafes now and there's matcha donuts, there's matcha ice cream, there's matcha everything. You know what? It's funny. I was just in Tokyo 2 weeks ago and I picked up some matcha Kit Kats for my friend. Just because they're just so ridiculous, you like have to bring them back, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. So it's in everything. But why is it that is Japan just like holding back the most prized matcha domestically, or how does?
No, I think it has to do with the way it's stored and packed before it gets to you. So even if they send out good quality matcha, if it's exposed to high temperatures, if it's exposed to air, if it sits around, it loses all of its good qualities. And I think it's just people don't know how to store it, how to prepare it. Now, of course, also there are many, many grades of matcha. The best grades are really too expensive for everyday use and maybe used only by real connoisseurs of the tea ceremony. But there are many less expensive grades that are still very, very good and bright green and flavorful. I just think that people are not knowledgeable about it. And I meet many people who've tried matcha and say they don't like it and they've never tasted real, really good matcha.
I feel like that's with anything, any food, you know, like a lot of these, I was that way with beets. I absolutely hated beets. And then you get some at the farmer's market.
Yep.
And you get them prepared the right way. And you're like, what? This isn't even the same flavor profile.
I had the same experience. Brussels sprouts also.
Exactly. That's another one.
So, Kevin, I was because I am such a fan of matcha, and because I'd met so many people here that never had the good stuff, I was really determined to make that available. So a couple of years ago, as you know, I started a company, Matchakari, and got the domain name, which was a great thing, matcha.com. And we import really good matcha from one producer in Uji, which is the town near Kyoto where the finest tea comes from. And we sell various grades of it, but we are really determined. Our mission is to make good quality matcha available here and to let people know how to use it.
Yeah, I'm in full disclosure, I invested a little bit of money into your venture as well. And I really enjoyed going through. I mean, we must have tasted like 20 plus different matchas, just really trying to hone in and find the absolute best one. So that was a lot of fun to experience, and cool to see you actually turn this into something that you're, you know, bringing back here to the States and having imported through Japan. What region is it coming from again?
It comes from a region called Uji, Uji. It's just a short distance from Kyoto. And that region traditionally has the reputation of producing the finest tea and the finest matcha. And can I just say that we're going to put up a link for your listeners that offers a 15% discount code if they come to matcha.com?
Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes so it's linked up there. But yeah, that'll be great, so people can go and try out the different types. What would you say for a first time matcha drinker? Is there any specific one on the site that you would say is best to try out?
There's one called Morning Ritual that's moderately priced, and I think is really terrific.
Yeah, I basically take my matcha, sift it through almost like a little strainer to, you know, kind of break up the clumps, and then I gotta admit I cheat. I don't actually use the whisk. Well, my whisk got like, you know, after a certain amount of time,
it gets frazzled.
You have to buy a new one. So I just got one of those little coffee, like, you know, it takes a AAA battery and it just like whisks it up like a latte frother.
They work great, Kevin. And I really like iced matcha. And what I do is I put like a glass of, I use room temperature water, three scoops of matcha, and then I use that electric whisk to whisk it up very quickly and then put ice cubes in it. I like it unsweetened, but it's beautiful drink and a really good one.
Yeah, I feel like it has enough natural sweetness, like good quality matcha does, where you don't even need to add anything to it.
But if you want, I mean, people make matcha lattes and soy matcha lattes. If you want to do that, that's fine. I like the pure stuff. By the way, there's another product that matcha.com has. It's Superior Organic. And that's also a good one that's moderately priced.
Awesome. I want to jump into the health benefits of tea in general, because it's been, I mean, we've been hearing that green tea is good for you for, you know, decades now. I'm curious, what does the current research say? And also, if you could speak to L-theanine, because I think that's a fascinating and awesome compound as well.
Well, let me take that one first. That's L-theanine is an amino acid. It's now available as a supplement also that produces a state of relaxation, calming, and in combination with caffeine, which is what exists in matcha, it produces a state of alert relaxation. And I think this is very different from the kind of stimulation that you get from coffee. I think many people find coffee to produce a jangling kind of energy and then a drop off afterwards. And matcha is very different. You are alert, but calm and focused. In terms of the health benefits of tea in general, there's an enormous body of research. A lot of it is population research, looking at large populations, evaluating their tea consumption and correlating that with health risks. So one of the most famous of these was a very large study done in Japan, thousands of people, that showed that drinking, I think it was 4 to 5 cups of green tea a day, was associated with lower all-cause mortality, that is, of dying from any cause. There are many specific studies showing that tea drinking lowers cardiovascular risk, protects against cancer, and so forth. And this is attributed mostly to the antioxidant content of green tea. Now, there are antioxidants in many other things. They're in coffee, they're in chocolate, they're in many fruits and vegetables. And it seems good to bolster your system with antioxidants to protect you against oxidative damage, which is something you accumulate as you go through life.
This is like obviously coming from like kind of green spectrum. So you're still of the belief like eat the rainbow, eat as many colors as possible.
Plants contain what are called phytonutrients, and many of these are pigments. Plants produce these pigments. They're part of their own defense system to protect them from damage from ultraviolet light, from other environmental stresses. And each color is associated with different specific protective effects. So it's a good idea, if you can, every day to eat across the color spectrum, to think about, you know, what did you eat today that was red? What did you eat that was green? What did you eat that was yellow? What did you eat that was green-white? What did you eat that was blue? That's a good way to think. And by covering the color spectrum, you're covering all your bases. Now, I should also say that while I think there is a role for taking dietary supplements and vitamins, I don't think that taking these things in supplement form reproduces the benefits of the whole foods as found in nature, because as best they're partial representations of the complexes that nature produces. Mm-hmm. They can be good against as insurance against gaps in the diet, but I think you want to eat the natural sources of them.
I see these studies come back about multivitamins and, you know, supplements that have no effect. Do you think it's because we're trying to isolate one ingredient and pull it out of its kind of natural place?
I have always argued, this goes back many, many years, and for a lot of that time, I got no traction with it in the scientific world. And now I'm happy to say that people are really coming around to this point of view, that there is a synergistic effect of complex natural mixtures of compounds as found in plants, and the beneficial effects on health. And when you isolate one of those compounds and take it in pure form, not only may you not get all the benefits, but you may increase risk by taking them out of that context.
Yeah, I've heard of some really scary things around, like, say, casein protein from milk when it's isolated, around the increased risk of cancer there.
A classic one was beta carotene.
Yes.
We knew that the carotenoid pigments had a protective effect against lung cancer, especially. And people, and I'm afraid I was guilty of this too, in one of my early books, advised smokers to take beta carotene supplementally. And then it turned out that when you take isolated beta carotene, it actually increases risk of lung cancer in smokers. So what you want to do is eat the vegetables that have carotenoid pigments in them, like carrots and things that are yellow and red.
So you're getting the full, like, mixed carotenes, I guess is what they call
that. Alpha carotene, beta carotene, lutein, zeaxanthin. I mean, there's a whole slew of these, and beta carotene is only one of them.
Wow. What are your thoughts on, as we get older, kind of brain enhancing compounds? I know on the internet and the biohacker community, there is just a big focus on, okay, how can we cognitively enhance our bodies? You know, via choline or bacopa or blueberries or lion's mane, like we mentioned before. What are your thoughts on doing that type of enhancement first and foremost? And then also, are there any that are worthwhile?
Okay, let me say first that I meet so many people and I see so many things on the internet about these miracle compounds. Some of them are pharmaceutical drugs. Some of them are isolated compounds from natural sources. And with a huge following of people, especially ultra athletes and people interested in high performance. And when I look at these, there often is very little hard scientific evidence of these effects in humans that are backed by human studies. You know, often there are a few animal studies and then people jump to the conclusion that these compounds have miraculous effects.
Right.
So I tend to be suspicious. And it's also, I worry that some of these things may actually be harmful. You know, I've just been hearing about, for example, rapamycin, which is a antibiotic that's used to prevent organ rejection. It's a strong immunosuppressant. And there's a lot of articles on the internet about this having miraculous longevity enhancing effects. I would be very wary of taking a strong immunosuppressant. Okay. But on the other hand, I think there are a lot of things that may be worth using. Certainly good antioxidant support, mostly by eating plenty of fruits and vegetables, herbs and spices and beverages, including tea. Then I think, you know, some of these mushrooms that we talked about can be very useful, probably principally lion's mane, since that has a neuroprotective effect. I think anti-inflammatory compounds can be useful because some of the degenerative diseases of the brain begin as inflammation.
What are some examples of anti-inflammatory compounds?
Well, the main one that's been most researched is curcumin in turmeric, the yellow spice. I think it's better to take turmeric than isolated curcumin. But that's one I would think that's very good to get in your diet regularly. India has the lowest rate of Alzheimer's in the world, and many people think that's because Indians eat turmeric at every meal from infancy to old age.
And do you take that with black pepper or no?
If you don't take it with black pepper, it doesn't get out of the GI tract. So if you're dealing with inflammation in the GI tract, it's okay to just take it plain. But if you want to get systemic effects, you need to take it with a black pepper extract.
Okay. And how do you typically just use turmeric in your cooking and then just like ground some black pepper over the top of it? Or what's your protocol?
I actually take a turmeric supplement. It's called Turmeric Whole Body, made by Mega Food Company, and it has a black pepper extract in it. I've been to Okinawa a number of times, and I'm going there again in a couple of weeks. And Okinawans drink a cold, unsweetened turmeric tea that's just delicious, but it's made from, they ferment the turmeric. It's just a delicious beverage. It's not the same as stirring turmeric powder into cold water. So I'd like to see that available here, and that's something that I'm working to do.
Is that a lacto fermentation?
Yes.
Oh, it is. Okay. So do you know how they ferment it? Like what is it similar as like a sauerkraut or something?
It is. I went to the company that makes it in Okinawa and I saw these big tanks where they were doing it, but I really didn't learn the details of the process.
Yeah, it'd be great. I know we don't get that out here, and that's something that'd be great to have.
And by the way, you mentioned fermentation. I'm a big fan of including fermented foods in the diet. I think these have also many healthful effects. I make my own sauerkraut and pickles. I've just been experimenting with radish kimchi. It's very easy to do.
Yeah, I noticed you use that device, which I've used in the past, called the Perfect Pickler.
A very good thing. This is basically a water seal that you can screw onto a 1-quart or 2-quart jar, and it makes fermentation very easy. Let me go back to what you said about the brain protective, brain enhancement. Mm-hmm. I also think you want to protect yourself from environmental harm. I think there are probably a lot of things out there that can cause trouble in the brain. I would bet that Parkinson's disease is going to be shown to be due to environmental toxic effect. We know that there's a high incidence among agricultural workers, and it may be that there's a variety of chemicals that set off this reaction in the brain that causes degeneration of key areas that affect motor function. There's a disease that closely resembles ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, in Guam that has been traced to consumption of a toxic nut, and a compound in it has been identified. So it's possible that many of these very serious neurodegenerative diseases are set off by environmental toxicity. So learning how to reduce that danger in your life is, I think, important. And I also think there are things you can do not taking substances to keep your brain healthy and active, such as trying to learn another language. You don't have to master it. Just the attempt to learn is very helpful.
What are your thoughts on omega-3s for brain health?
I think they're crucial, especially one of them, DHA, docosahexaenoic acid. And we know that in pregnancy, this is rapidly absorbed by the fetal brain in the last trimester of pregnancy. So very good idea for pregnant women to supplement with that. I think in our part of the world, most people are deficient in omega-3 fatty acids. They don't eat enough fish, or they don't get other sources of them. One interesting fact that I came across is that the country in the world that has the lowest incidence of depression, and I think most people would never guess this, is Iceland. And you wonder, how do they get away with that up there in the cold and dark, and their economy has been terrible? They have the highest serum omega-3 levels of any people in the world, higher than Japanese. They eat not only all the fish, but they roast seabirds that gorge on fish, and they eat cheese and dairy products, especially sheep milk. Sheep graze on Arctic grasses and plants that have omega-3s in them and concentrate them in their fat and milk.
What are your thoughts on cheese and milk in general?
I hated milk as a kid and was forced to drink it. And I had in early life chronic bronchitis, which I'm sure was due to milk drinking. However, I love fermented milk products. So I like high quality yogurt, especially Greek and Middle Eastern yogurt. And I like high quality cheese. And there's some very interesting research showing that saturated fats, you know, not all saturated fats are equal. And it looks as if the saturated fat in beef is particularly unhealthy for our hearts and blood vessels. And the saturated fat in cheese, not in butter, not in cream, but specifically in cheese, may actually have a heart protective effect.
Wow.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, I think the cheese that I grew up on was horrible. You know, it was one of the worst things that Americans did to a natural product. It was fake cheese. You know, real cheese is a living culture of organisms. I like cheeses from high mountain areas in Europe. These also have a better fatty acid profile. I think great cheeses from France and Italy. And I'm happy to say there now are some, you know, really good cheeses being made in America.
And does this apply to just aged cheeses, like an aged cheddar, or is this like also,
Yes, it does. Most cheeses sold in supermarkets are dead. There are no living organisms there. You want cheeses that ripen and change over time.
So raw cheeses, basically?
Yes, if you can get them and, you know, well, there's a whole range of them, but you know, as you learn about cheese and learn about the ones that are living cultures, they were a fermented food.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, what about the ones that I in particular that I have to say I absolutely love is like these triple creme cheeses, but I feel like it's cheating. Like those can't be good for you, right?
Well, they're very high in fat and saturated fat. Again, as I said, the dairy fat may be not harmful and even beneficial, but you're getting a lot of calories there. I mean, there's a reason why we like them. You know, we like fat.
Yeah.
But you know, those are ripened cheeses with living cultures in them.
That's awesome. Well, that's a great news for me. I'm definitely going to cut more of the beef out and go for the cheese instead. I'm curious about your take on, like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, you've just been so like prescient on so many different things that have happened over the years. There seems to be a couple big emerging trends, one being fasting and the other one being microdosing, like LSD and mushrooms and things of that nature. Sure. What are your thoughts on both of those?
Well, I mean, fasting is a very interesting subject, and there are lots of different ways of doing fasting. At the moment, there's great interest in intermittent fasting, and there are various ways of doing that. One is compressing your eating into 8 hours during the day, doing this every day or several days a week. I think there is very good evidence that intermittent fasting has a beneficial effect on metabolism. And in particular can help with regulation of blood glucose levels. It may also help people lose weight. It may be a specific corrective for people with metabolic syndromes. As I say, there seems to be all different ways of doing it, and it's worth experimenting to see what agrees with you. But I think that's one I would really recommend and try. There also is longer term fasting, say water only for a period of time. I think that has to be done under supervision because it can be dangerous, but there's some interesting medical literature showing that long term water fasts can put some serious autoimmune diseases into total remission, particularly asthma, rheumatoid arthritis, ulcerative colitis. The diseases often come back when people start to eat again, but if you transition them from fasting onto a vegan diet and then to a vegetarian diet, then maybe to a pesco vegetarian diet, you can often maintain the remission.
Hmm. Wow. That's fascinating. Would you know any length of time when those benefits start to appear?
You know, I've seen it. This can be done after, you know, a month, 6 weeks, or even longer of just water-only fasting. As I say, this has to be done under supervision because it's a drastic alteration of metabolism.
I know that when I was talking to my doctor, they had me supplement with magnesium to prevent kind of like some muscle spasms and things like that I was getting when I tried a 5-day water-only fast.
It may be worth supplementing with basic vitamins and minerals as well.
Mm-hmm. How about your thoughts on the whole craziness around microdosing?
Well, I am fascinated by the incredible popularity of this and the way that it seems to be penetrating different levels of society. I mean, I've seen people in popular TV series microdosing, so it is certainly getting into the mainstream. I'm curious as to where this started and how far back it goes. I'm not sure. I don't think it has that long a history behind it. I've met people who are really big fans of doing this and do it every day and have done it over a number of years and say that it's greatly enhanced their creativity. I tried microdosing on LSD. And I did not like the effect. I didn't like the energy that created my body, and it lasted way too long. But I have been microdosing with psilocybin mushrooms, 100 milligram doses, and I find that interesting and useful. And it seems to, I have done it once a week or a couple times a week. I think it's had a very positive effect on my mood, and I just like it. So I'm interested in experimenting with it more.
Yeah, I tried the microdosing of LSD, and I tried it once, and I felt like it was like taking like three cups of coffee one after another. Yep. And I didn't get any creativity out of it. And granted, same. This was like around, I don't know, 15 micrograms or so, maybe mm-hmm. 20 micrograms. And I've heard that the creativity piece kicks in around 50. And this is all sub. There's no hallucinogen effect at this point. I guess it's after 50 when the kind of you start seeing visuals.
Huh. I'm not motivated to do that because I just didn't like the quality of the energy, but I have friends who swear by it.
Yeah. What are your, this must be just a, someone that's been following and writing about this for so many years, you just must be pretty stoked that this is finally becoming mainstream, right?
Amazing. You know, I first, took mescaline in, 1960. So, and, was experimenting with psychedelics, in the late 60s, 70s, had very interesting experiences with them, wrote about them. And I just am fascinated to see this now, this great reawakening of interest in them. By the way, I've always been, if people talk about their usefulness for psychological growth, spiritual growth, I also think they have many medical applications that I'd love to see applied if they became legally available. Because many people that have chronic illnesses, whether it's chronic pain, autoimmune diseases, if they can have the experience of having even a few hours without that condition, that's motivation to find ways of making that happen more of the time. And the key is by changing something in your mind, by changing the way that you are interpret the experience of your body.
Hmm. And what conditions do you think that applies to? Would that be something like, say you have an allergy to something?
Allergies easy. I think that's one that's easy to disappear. Autoimmune diseases. I have a friend who had very severe rheumatoid arthritis, a young man, and took MDMA and had a very profound experience on it and went into total remission that has lasted for many years now.
Wow. That's crazy. Do you think that, I've been watching all these studies out of Johns Hopkins and especially around psilocybin and end of life and cancer patients and just some of the amazing benefits that people are walking away from after just a single session. Mm-hmm. And I also did a very, I haven't told you this yet, but I did a very guided, really high dose psilocybin session. And I was able to go in and address a lot of issues I had with my father. And Great. It was just a very beautiful thing to resolve a lot of that. Mm-hmm. Do you think that, I feel like in the next 5-10 years, we could be seeing clinics where you'll go in and actually work with a physician or work with a guide to, is that going to be a reality? Do you feel?
It looks like we're moving in that direction. Isn't your state, is there?
Yeah. It's on the docket.
Yeah. What's happening there?
Well, they just have it. So next time we go up for elections, there's going to be the making psilocybin a prescribable compound. And so I know that I'm not sure if you will have to stay at the doctor's office and take it under their guidance. I believe that was what I have to go in and dig a little bit deeper, but we could be legal in Oregon pretty soon.
That'd be amazing. You know, it's worth pointing out to people who oppose this, that these drugs, the true psychedelics, are the least toxic drugs known to medicine. I mean, you can't kill people with them. Their physical toxicity is negligible and much, much, much less than that of many common drugs that we give to people for medical conditions. So on a physical level, they are extremely safe. And the main dangers of them are psychological, bad trips. And that can easily be moderated or eliminated by paying careful attention to set and setting and taking the drugs in the right dose and the right environment and creating the right expectations around them.
Yeah. And it's when I hear these stories about people, you know, whether it be end-of-life cancer patients or you have people that are hooked on opioids that go in for some of these sessions and have great outcomes. It's like, it's just another compound that nature has provided us. Like, why not go in there, and especially given the opioid crisis that's going on today, and experiment? Like, we need something to help us out.
I think the opioid crisis will turn out to be a great boon for integrative medicine in general, because it's very clear that you cannot manage chronic pain syndrome just with opioids. You get into a lot of trouble. You have to have personalized integrative treatment that includes dietary change, recommendations for physical activity, mind-body interventions, acupuncture, yoga, herbal support, as well as the possibility of structured psychedelic experiences.
You know, I heard, I don't know if you were joking or not on Joe Rogan's podcast, but about having Dr. Weil centers that you could go to. Would that ever be a reality? Like something that you would endorse and get behind?
I'd love to see it. I talk specifically about a method to lose allergies, because I have told many people that I had a lifelong cat allergy that disappeared instantly during an LSD trip that I had long ago, and I've never had a reaction since. So my idea would be to have people come in with whatever they were allergic to and start them off with a full dose of a psychedelic and present the allergen, and they would not have the allergic reaction. And they'd come and say 10 sessions a week apart. And each time you give them a lower dose of the psychedelic, they wouldn't know. And at some point they'd be getting none, just a pill that had none of the psychedelic in it. And they would have unlearned the allergic response.
That's insane. So it's basically, you know, I'd heard about like slowly introducing allergens at a very micro dose and kind of ramping up. Like, so what's going on chemically behind the scenes here? Like, how can you just take a psychedelic and all of a sudden not be allergic to something?
That's complicated. And I don't know exactly. You know, psychedelics create an adrenergic state when they're all stimulants, and they increase production and circulation of noradrenaline, and adrenaline and noradrenaline suppress allergic reactions. That's one part of it, but I think the main part is in the mind. My sense is that when I had a cat approach me prior to that experience, I would jerk into a defensive posture, and that defensive attitude, which originated in my mind, I think that keys up the immune system to react in that way. You can, people who are allergic to roses, you can show them a plastic rose and they have an allergic reaction. So this is a learned response. And I think it's connected with that defensive posture. There's something about when you defend yourself, it creates a sort of rigidity in the body, and that is favorable to that kind of reaction. And when you're in a totally non-defensive, relaxed state, you could be in the presence of something that bothered you and not have that reaction.
That's fascinating. Yeah. So if you decide to open a center,
All right.
I want to talk real quick about glucose, because I know that so many people are calling Alzheimer's disease like a type 3 diabetes. You know, it seems to be like an epidemic out there with people with that are right borderline pre-diabetic. Do you think that glucose is a potential? I mean, it's creating inflammation, is it not? At those levels,
glucose is the main fuel of the body. the brain can only live on glucose. The neurons are so specialized that they've lost the metabolic equipment to process any other kind of fuel. So glucose is not a bad thing. It's the basic energy currency of the body, but it's desirable to have glucose levels in the blood stable. Now, the reason that there is so much pre-diabetes, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, this is a genetic legacy. We evolved in periods when food was generally scarce and people lived near the border of starvation most of the time or experienced feast and famine kind of eating. You know, food was present sometimes and not there at other times. In response to that environment, we evolved genes. These are often called thrifty genes that enable us to store up energy very efficiently when calories are present. Those genes, which many, many people in our population have inherited, now work against us when we have available food all the time, often in great abundance and variety. And many of those foods are very easily digested and processed into glucose. So all these people with metabolic syndrome, pre-diabetes, if you put them in circumstances where food was limited or the right kinds of foods were there, I think all these things would recede. There's one very dramatic example. The native peoples who live just west of Tucson, called the Oodham, it was a big tribe. They were sedentary agriculturalists, physically active. They grew corn, beans, and squash, the traditional Southwest diet. They did not shun carbohydrates. They ate starchy tubers, but the carbohydrates they ate were slow digesting carbohydrates. They were lean, active people. The territory that Tucson is in is part of the Gadsden Purchase, which, if you remember from high school history, this was a slice of North America that we bought from Mexico in the middle 1800s. The line went right through their territory. So half of the Oodham are in Mexico, half of them are in Arizona. The Mexican Oodham still pretty much look the way they always did, lean, healthy, agricultural peoples. The Arizona Oodham have ballooned up into 300 and 400 pound individuals with 90% rates of hypertension, adult onset diabetes. I've seen I've seen type 2 diabetes diagnosed in Oodham kids as young as 3 and 4, often preceded by massive obesity that begins at age 1 or 2. Their diets are all the worst offerings of American junk food. It's ringdings and big gulps of cola. There was a very interesting study here at the University of Arizona where a small group of these incredibly obese, hypertensive, diabetic Oodhams were put back on their traditional diets of corn, beans, squash, native foods, and the fat melted off, the hypertension disappeared, and the diabetes went into remission.
So if folks are out there listening and they have elevated glucose, so they want to get under control, you would say, first and foremost, non-refined carbohydrates.
Yeah, really learn about the glycemic index and glycemic load and apply that to the foods you eat. Second, you want to be physically active. Third, you want to deal with stress in your life. There are also some natural products that are helpful in stabilizing or lowering blood glucose. One is the prickly pear cactus. That's a traditional remedy used in Mexico. So there are extracts of the fruit and leaves available. Another is an Asian vegetable I'm sure you're familiar with called bitter melon. Mm-hmm. Also in Okinawa, people would drink little jiggers of bitter melon juice, but they would follow it with a glass of freshly pressed sugarcane juice. And to take the taste away. But anyway, that's a very effective blood sugar stabilizer. So I think primarily diet, physical activity, possible stress management, and then some of this use of natural substances that can help. And most cases of pre-diabetes or early type 2 diabetes can be put into remission just with lifestyle change.
Hey, what are your thoughts on cinnamon?
It's useful. We don't have a lot of research on it, but it looks as if it is helpful in lowering blood sugar. And I think taking a teaspoon of cinnamon a day, or you can buy this in capsules, not a bad thing to try.
I'd love to jump into your predictions for the future. You've been so good at this. I'm curious,
What are you looking at now, kind of either foods or compounds or things where you're just like scratching your head and saying, I'm going to start paying attention to this. I'm not sure there's enough science to back it up, or maybe there is enough science to back it up, but we just don't know about it yet. Are there certain things that are catching your attention these days?
I think that stem cell therapy is on the horizon. I don't think we're there yet in many of the places that offer stem cell therapy. I wouldn't go near, but I think this latest research from Japan, where they were able to take stem cells from skin and have them revert back to totipotential embryonic cells that could then differentiate into any sort of cell or tissue. I think we're very close to being able to regenerate spinal cords, get pancreases that are inactive become active again, to repair areas of heart muscle damaged by heart attacks. I think this whole era of regenerative medicine is very close, and that's fascinating.
What do you think about the athletes that are getting like stem cell, you know, injections into their joints and things
of
that nature?
I'm just really wary of potential very bad adverse effects of that, because I think the centers that are offering this now, I think the products that they're using are unregulated, possibly dangerous. We're just not there yet. I would not recommend stem cell therapy yet, but I think we're very close.
Okay.
Another one is, I think that comes out of genomics, is that we're going to be able to have really individualized medicine to know, who should be on a low fat diet, who should be on a low carb diet, who should take a statin, who should not take a statin. I think it's going to make possible a much more precise and clean kind of medicine as we understand individual genetic differences.
Yeah, I've been kind of fascinated with this area. I take my 23andMe data and export it out, and there's a whole variety of different tools now where you can import it into and look at your genetic polymorphisms and then say, okay, well, we have some data around this particular morphism, and should I be, like, for example, I have MTHFR, right? Mm-hmm. So I have higher homocysteine levels, uh-huh. and so I know maybe I should be taking some methylated, you know, B vitamins, yep. or up my methylated folate a little bit. And when you know that, it's fascinating because you can apply these very specific little changes and see impacts in your blood numbers.
You know, a larger issue is the whole healthcare mess. I think it's quite possible that the current healthcare system will deconstruct totally, and that's the only way we're going to be able to create something different. Mm-hmm. I very much believe that integrative medicine is the way of the future. I think it's more cost effective, more useful, and that's something that I've been working to create for a long time.
Yeah, where can people, because I know that you train physicians from all over the world, where can people get more information on that?
Go to the website of the University of Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine, which is integrativemedicine.arizona.edu.
That's great. One of the things I wanted to get your take on before I let you go is I've just been reading a lot on ibuprofen and these NSAIDs. Is that
NSAIDs,
how you say it?
Yeah.
It looks like there's some pretty damning evidence out there for the toxicity around these. What are your thoughts on consuming these?
Well, NSAIDs are very useful drugs, but I don't think they're safe in long-term use. So I think someone who takes first of all, a problem is that these are so widely available over the counter in various forms that people think that they're benign. I think if you take these occasionally for musculoskeletal pain or other problems, they can be very helpful. But if you take them long-term, the risk particularly of GI bleeding is great. And there are, I think the statistic that I saw is that there are 20,000 deaths a year in this country from stomach hemorrhages in people on NSAIDs. And usually these are in people that had no prior symptoms. It's not people that have heartburn or irritation when they take them. It's just out of the blue, they have a stomach bleed and die.
Wow. That's crazy. That's terrifying. What are some of the alternatives that people can do out there? Like, do you recommend what is it that aspirin's made out of? Is that white willow bark? Or?
Yes, but the problem is that white willow bark, it's a weak analgesic. And if you take enough of it to get an analgesic effect, the stomach irritating effects are terrible. So this derivative, acetyl salicylic acid, you know, was much more effective as a pain reliever, has other interesting effects. It greatly reduces risk of GI cancers, esophageal cancer, colon cancer. So it's a useful agent, but it also creates this risk of bleeding. So it has to be used very cautiously.
Are you talking about aspirin in general?
Aspirin is an NSAID. So
right.
It's one of that category. I mentioned reishi mushrooms earlier as being an anti-inflammatory, useful, often with an effect equivalent to ibuprofen, but it has none of that adverse effect or bleeding potential. Also an anti-inflammatory diet, something that I recommended before anybody else was talking about that. You can moderate inflammation by choosing the foods you eat, particularly the right fats, the right kinds of carbohydrates, enough of the protective elements. And you can find that details of that anti-inflammatory diet on my website, drweil.com, drweil.com.
Yeah, you have that food pyramid that you came up with, like a modified, your own version of it that I thought was great.
It has. And you remember at the very top is dark chocolate.
That's right, which I'm a big fan of.
And green tea is also in that as recommended beverage.
That's great. So last question, herbs and spices you mentioned. You know, I enjoy rosemary. I've heard about some of the beneficial effects there. Anything else in the herbs and spice category?
I talked about these phytonutrients, these protective phytonutrients that are in plants. You want to get as many of them and as many different kinds into you as possible. And the way to do that is to eat regularly a great variety of fruits, vegetables, herbs, spices, beverages, and I would say even intoxicants, things like marijuana, coca, cot, chocolate. All of these have unique compounds in them. And with herbs and spices, I think as many as possible, get familiar with ones that you don't usually use. Nigella seeds, black cumin, fenugreek, asafoetida, you know, all these spices that are used in various parts of the world, they all have unique phytoprotective compounds in them.
And it's fun too.
And it's fun too.
I love going to the grocery store and just buying random stuff and then looking it up later and figuring out how to cook it. It's part of the fun.
Good.
Well, Dr. Weil, thank you so much for being on the show. Obviously, we want people to drink as much matcha as possible, high quality matcha, because it's healthy for you. But I really appreciate the fact that you spent all the time to find the best source of it and bring it to the States. So matcha.com for all of that. And we'll have links in the show notes for 15% off a coupon code as well, which is great.
Thank you, Kevin. And let's work on getting together again soon.
I'd love that. Let's do it. And if you ever want to come out to Oregon, or I can meet you in Washington and we can do a little walking mushroom, that would be fun.
I'd love it.
All right. That is it for this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, the number one thing you can do is head on over to the iTunes store where the podcasts live. Do a search for The Kevin Rose Show and give us a 5-star review. That helps our podcast get recommended to more people. And when more people see it, I get even better guests for the show. Thank you so much. And we'll see you next time.